Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their teardrop trailer that they have nicknamed Maggie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. For the past 3 years, they have been filming a documentary about heritage breed animals entitled The Holstein Dilemma, Heritage Breeds, and the Need for Biodiversity. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara, and welcome back to our podcast. Today, I'm going to go all out on the superlatives for the intro because they very much apply to the event that we visited this weekend. Most beautiful fibers, strongest wool, softest cashmere, richest colors, most amazing sweaters, most varied creations, finest people. Technically, the name of the weekend marathon is the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival. It's held in Rhinebeck, and it's put on by the Dutchess County Sheep and Wool Growers Association. It's been that way for the last 39 years. That means that, like many fairs, the way people refer to it indicates either their age or their interest area or where they live. I've heard it referred to as the Dutchess County Sheep and Wool Fair, the Rhinebeck Sheep and Wool Fair, the Rhinebeck Fiber Fair, and the Dutchess County Wool Festival, among other things. But the whole thing started out as a sheep sale. We had the opportunity to speak with one of the gentlemen that was there at the very beginning, Philip Seymour, and he'll tell you a bit of how it got started. He knows quite a bit about Rhinebeck history, and I think we'll bring you more on that in the future. If it tells you anything, the Welcome to Rhinebeck sign has a year on it that starts with 16. Wow. Then we'll bring you a quick conversation with the 16 volunteers that put on this event. That statement might not seem like much until you have an idea of the scale we're talking about here. We don't exactly know the headcount yet for this weekend, but I believe the average attendance was 45,000 people a few years back. Probably now that in its first day. There was such a crowd at the end of Saturday, it took us 2.5 hours to go 18 miles on our way back to the farmhouse where we're staying. And it's all run by a handful of volunteers with a bare-bones entry fee. If you're interested in helping out this amazing group of people next year, please let them know and the fiber gods will smile on you. They're the engine that runs this whole thing. We'll give you a quick moment for the Shave 'em to Save 'em meetup in this podcast. Shave 'em to Save 'em is a program that started by the Livestock Conservancy to help promote heritage animals and all they offer to the fiber world, from start to finish. In addition to this podcast excerpt, we'll give you a video up on the YouTube channel for Backyard Green Films, so you can get a visual on the wonderful clothing made from the different kinds of breeds and the very creative people that made them. And last but not least is our farmer and another amazing volunteer, Jerry, a sheep person. Okay, so right here I should stop and tell you that on Saturday morning, the livestock barns were the first for us, of course. I began to feel as though maybe it was a mistake to start in the sheep barn, because we went out the filming gate at 8:30 a.m. that morning, and we didn't manage to escape the gravitational pull by 10 a.m. on Sunday, still in the sheep barn. Cotswold, Gotland, Santa Cruz, Leicester, Shetland, Icelandic, Jacob, Merino, Tunis, Valet Blacknose. It would take another 15 minutes to list all the breeds, I think. We'll definitely bring you other breed-specific sheep podcasts in the near future because the sheep people are just plain fantastic, and they were all generously willing to talk to us. And for our podcast, last but not least, is our farmer and another amazing volunteer, Jerry, a sheep person, at Flying Fibers Farm, though, because we asked her about wool. And again, the sweater thing goes on in my head, and at this event, it's very much about fiber. That starts with the animal side of things. Jerry was just about the most wonderful, gracious, helpful person I've ever met. She raises Wensleydale sheep in the spare time from her teaching career, land management, and volunteer work managing the breed barn at the festival. She was also very patient with both my tendency to stop and pronounce the word Wensleydale every single time like Wallace might, and my second tendency to reach out and feel the wool on the sleeve of her hand-knitted sweater every 4.5 minutes. That's a serious behavioral problem that crops up at this event, by the way, and I am not the only one with this issue. The festival has about 40-odd thousand people walking around, and half of them are showing off the best of their handmade crafting. It's like walking around in an exhibit of texture and color and skill, and I've never seen so many gorgeous sweaters and hats and scarves and skirts and other knitwear in my life. I was rubbernecking like a tourist. Fashion and design houses are paying attention, as you can tell. We had the amazing Isabella Rossellini there with the Parsons School of Design. Anyway, on my way home Saturday night, we finally had to make a command decision that we just had to see what other things were there in the other barns. And just one more interview in the sheep area and we would do it. I'll list some of the other critters, as that same time warp issue came up when we hit the other barns. It's not just us and the sheep. Camelid and cashmere animals, goats, llamas, alpacas, rabbits. Obviously, it's going to take us about 10 years of going back again to the festival to get through the barns at this rate, but I'm willing to go through that if I have to, I've told Rick. There are barns and barns of vendors there, too, with wonderfully distracting things on display. Wool, yarn, hats, felt, fabric, rugs, pins, implements, jewelry, equipment, patterns, and just about everything else you could possibly imagine that came from a piece of fiber. And some that you couldn't imagine, but somebody else did. There were also talks on pasture restoration, raising a flock, shearing, livestock guardian, and herding dogs. One of the best things I learned from this weekend was that the fibers we use, much like our world today, are a blend of many things. We have things that could be considered strengths or weaknesses, depending upon perspective. But in the fiber world, it's very obvious in both its subtle and overt forms that something that could be considered a weakness by one person is very much a strength to another. Cashmere, for example, might not be the kind of fiber that you want to make an outer work sweater out of. But if you put a little cashmere in with your sturdier wool, you might have a wonderful blend that has both softness and strength. The varieties are endless in the fiber world, and judging from the things we saw this weekend, there are new combinations and ideas popping up all the time. We're recording this morning's introduction from a farmhouse in Woodstock, which was our lodging for the last few days. We had a hard time finding a place to stay closer than that. But a farmhouse in Woodstock seems a poetic place to stay when you think about it. Woodstock had a little event here some years ago that started out as one thing, but grew and grew into something that not only changed the community and the local economy, but also brought people together in a way that nobody expected. I think that no matter what you call it, the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival, the Rhinebeck Fiber Fest, the Dutchess County Wool Fair, or, if you're a volunteer, the annual test of stamina and strength. But no matter what, it was one of the most enjoyable events we've ever been to. And coming back last night, we were more tired than I think we've ever been. And for the last superlative, it's definitely one of the most favorite trips to go back to next year, if we can swing it. Here's part one of our two-part podcast on the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival 2019, held in Rhinebeck, New York.
Okay, so let's start by, if you could introduce yourself and tell me your connection to this show.
Okay, I'm Phil Seymour, and we were the manager of the first program. And we started off with, basically it was the bread use sale. And then a lot of people in our organization, Dutchess County Sheep and Wool, went to Maryland Festival. So some of them professed an interest in starting a wool festival. So we took that beef barn right over there next to this sheep barn, and on a Friday night we'd put up the plastic. Saturday morning we'd have the show and the sale, and the wool festival was in a barn. You know, we had to clean out the stall because that was the beef. We had all the you know, bedding and all we had to get rid of and clean it out and all. And it just developed from there, you know, one day. And then probably maybe another couple of years before we got another couple of buildings. And by the time I retired, we had the whole top of the hill here, the whole hill. And they wanted to expand beyond that because they were really developing. And it was partially, you know, a lot of it had to do with our very strong organization. Dutchess County, basically, a lot of the members were from Ulster County, Columbia County, right north of here. And you can see in the fairs, If it wasn't for Dutchess County sheep, the fairs wouldn't have a sheep show, basically. So getting back to the festival, and it, you know, it just gradually expanded, and they started doing some cooking, lamb cooking demonstrations down in the 4-H dining hall kitchen, and it was amazing. I mean, we developed, they would have people, vendors from Oregon, all over the place, you know, and it was just, it took us a while, and then we pretty much outgrew Maryland. You know, we were the biggest festival east of Mississippi at that point. And, you know, we had, oh my God, they had all the barns up here were full. I mean, even the barn up there, the first couple of years, we had really expanded. We had sheep in, or not sheep, but the vendors. And then back when we started, the wool animals weren't in really in vogue yet. I mean, that's why Maryland Festival was doing so well, because that's where you went if you were into fiber and sheep wool. I mean, you could see it in the sale. We were probably 90% meat animals, meat breeds. I mean, yeah, you'd collect the wool and all, but it was very small. And then as it got bigger, they wanted to have more wool shows, wool sheep shows. And it just kept developing like that. I remember one lady over in the, when we took over the rabbit barn, you know, we had to move all the pens aside. Chuck Simmons from Bard College made up these panels. We had these white panels that were like 4 foot wide by 8 foot high, so we could hide all the panels or all the pens behind the panels, you know. And we did those for like 4 or 5 years. You know, we'd had the stuff up in my barns and all of that. But it was amazing. I mean, every year I'd go around talking to the vendors, you know, revisiting them. And, you know, it was pretty amazing. I mean, some of the places we, well, up here, the wool group from Frankenmuth, Michigan, upper Michigan. And that's also the capital of this famous Christmas ornament place. I mean, anything you can think of for Christmas decoration. I mean, huge building.
I can see where that has fed into a certain portion of your vendors.
Yeah. And, you know, we had, you know, one lady came down from Nova Scotia where there were Icelandic sheep. Little old lady. She had another place, I think, in New Jersey or something. But little old lady, just, you know, just beautiful lady, you know, and it was just so amazing to see. And then they started more of the wool classes, and then they, like on a Saturday and Sunday, they'd have all these classes for the wool, like it's going on right here, right now. And it was a changeover from just the meat animals, and the wool animals were really coming in vogue up in this area. And it was amazing how it grew.
Okay, ladies, tell us where we are and when we are and who you are, please.
We are at the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival. It was established in 1980 in Rhinebeck, New York, first, and it's a wonderful event. I'm Mary Stevens. I'm on the board for the Dutchess County Sheep and Wool Growers Association.
And I'm Nana Johnson, and I'm the festival manager, and it's our 39th year.
I'm Jerry Robinson Lawrence, and I help with the breed barn coordination with Mary. And this is probably my 5th year doing that, but about my 8th year showing my Wensleydales here.
Good morning. My name's Andrew Parent Tibbetts. I oversee the camelids and cashmere barns, so llamas and alpacas. I have been exhibiting for 10 years, overseeing the barn itself for 5 years.
Okay, so now we only have 4 of you. But what many people don't know is that this is a volunteer-run event. Is that correct?
It is. It is. The board is all volunteer, and then the festival committee itself is as well volunteer. And we're always looking for new volunteers, right, Nana?
Well, I learned you have something like 45,000 people that show up on the weekend. Is that true? That
can't
be
easy.
Right.
That would be maybe yesterday.
That's a phenomenal thing. And you're telling me you have under 20 people to run this whole thing? That's phenomenal.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
and you're all very tired.
They work hard, yes.
And so I'm taking 15 minutes out of your very, very busy day because they're all going to come through the gates at 9 a.m., right?
Yes, very dedicated staff of volunteers. This is what we do. It's our passion. Most of us have animals or are somehow related to agriculture, and they're very passionate about it and making it thrive.
So you've segmented this in a very intelligent fashion, because when you say the stock barn, does that mean the sheep stock barn or the goat stock barn or all the stock? Because I didn't even make it barely out of the sheep barn yesterday, and there's like 14 more barns to go, right?
The breed barn.
The breed barn, yes.
That's the breed display barn, yes.
Okay.
Well, and they're not even local. It started being local. Exhibitors would bring in their sheep and display each breed and do outreach and education that way. Now it's turned into, they come from all over the country, and we try to vary the breeds of sheep, and so there's meat sheep in there, there's wool sheep in there. I think we tried to get dairy sheep, but didn't work out yet. But so people can learn about the different types of sheep and what their specific characters are, and this is good for hand spinning, this is better for felting, this is better for, and it's, I think, similar with the llamas and alpacas, that different ones do different things maybe. So that's not my forte.
Yeah, it's not my forte either. And I will say that this is our first jump into sheep, even though we have seen, you know, Jacob's American in our travels, and Cotswold, and Wensleydale, and all of those types of different breeds. But I can see how spinners and weavers and all of these different craft related, clothing related things, the textile industry, this is a huge thing. And really, animal breeds are very different in terms of what they provide to those different textiles.
And how they're handled. We have a beginning shepherds or sheep 101 course, beginning shepherds talk, and it's very well attended. And because people want to get into sheep, and they don't know, if you've never done sheep, they don't know what to look for or what they want it to do, you know. So I always tell people, if you're going to do it, research your do your homework before you just jump off and buy a sheep. So
breed specific barns, tell me what kind of animals you have, not just the breeds of sheep, but you also have what, llamas, and tell me the kinds of things you have.
Mm-hmm. I'll pass that.
Thank you. Just a little bit of history is I've always been, I call myself a fiber enthusiast, and knit when I was young. And as I got older, I said, I can now have my own fiber animals, and was trying to find something unusual here in Dutchess County. And I love the sheep, but there was a lot of them. And I said, let's see what else we could do that is fiber related. And that's how we got into llamas. And then, of course, once you get a couple llamas, you get a couple alpacas, and it kind of goes from there. Since then, I've purchased a farm, and my niche is developing a small fiber farm. And though there are many fiber farms and a lot of very talented artists, my focus is the education, exactly what Mary said, is there's specific fibers for specific purposes. You know, there's a lot of people that say, oh, I'm allergic to wool, I have a wool sweater. I said, well, more than likely they use the wrong wool to go against your skin. And that's, I think, what's so fun and intriguing here at this festival, because there's so many very clever, innovative people doing really interesting things with fiber. And so as an artist or enthusiast or someone who's looking to learn, this is the festival to come to, because it's so diverse in everything that's offered out there. So my side is I do the llama and alpaca, and then we have it processed, and we make it into roving, into yarn, and all of that. So there are specific people who are dedicated to a species, but the point, for, I think, for all of us is to open their minds up and realize there's a lot of diversity and a lot of opportunity amongst the fibers.
Well, diversity is one thing that we really focus on, and I think that that's really reflective of this, because you have big chunks of culture and style and heritage and craft. You might have a sweater that's 80%, you know, one kind of wool, and then 20% another. It's a mix of many things, and yet still has the characteristics of some of these main things, which to me is very reflective of America in a way. And so here at this place, you have that not just in the breed barn, but in the entirety of the location where we are. So now tell me your favorite things, just really quickly, because I know you're all busy. Tell me your favorite things. Is it the sheep herding or the llamas or some of the things that you enjoy here, really quickly?
I think my favorite, I think you've already talked to them a little bit, but my favorite is the breed talks and the shepherd talks that go on next door to the breed barn, just because that's the chance to introduce people that, as Mary was saying, who are maybe just have the little sort of flicker of interest in getting into this, and what we need are more producers. So I love seeing that that's a place where we can actually hopefully have some kind of a beginning impact for folks as they get to know what's out there and what they could work with. So.
Beautiful. Jerry?
I love the breed barn, of course. But I will say that because of you, my daughter sold her car and bought a llama.
I like that initiative.
Yes, a few years back. But my other favorite thing about the event is the walking fashion show and seeing what everybody's done through the year.
I'm going to have to say it's the actual sheep show. People bring in their livestock from home, and their produce, their... what they're so proud of that they've worked on all year and show and get placed and win prizes. And because the people line up the stands, and this is a big educational outreach for me because most of these people are so far removed from the farm. We used to say 3 or 4, now it's probably 5 to 10 generations removed from the farm. So they don't know where their food comes from. They don't know where their fiber comes from. And the ones that are wearing the fashion shows here are really in kind of connected. They want to know, oh, that's, you know, if they could buy the yarn from Sally the sheep, they'll be like, oh, I'm going to wear Sally, you know. So they really connect. It makes sense to me.
And I'm going to do somewhat of a personal plug, but I'm a 4-H leader. 4-H is a national club, youth development, and we love the opportunity that we are one of the few 4-H clubs here that can come and exhibit and at the same time educate people about llamas and alpacas. I know you have 4-H for sheep also, because that is our future. This is our next group of hopefully people who will take over agriculture and hopefully grow it even larger. So one of the things that we do here on Sundays is we call it Leaping Llama, but it's really Leaping Species, and it's meant to engage the public. It's meant to bring in some fun, and so the kids get involved, and everyone's cheering on for one another, and they just come out feeling good. The children who have participated, the people who have come to the festival.
But it's not just a kids thing, because everybody under 30, kind of as we've discussed before, there's a search for meaning. And so this is something where, you know, the kids are shopping at thrift stores now, and they're, you know, that's their preference because they want something that has age and history and meaning. How much more meaning do you have when you've actually made the sweater or raised the sheep? That, I mean, this seems like something that you could hit a revitalization of your new volunteer crew.
Well, yeah, and then we do. Like Andrea said, I have a 4-H club, and they are our future leaders. They are the future managers. They're the future producers that are going to show the sheep here, are going to have the booths here and sell their yarn and their fiber and their meat as well. I mean, we do have a large lamb offering here, so... And through the year as well. So yeah.
It's a connection to all of those things, though.
Yes.
Where does my food come from? Where do my clothes come from? And what did
it is,
take to
it
get
is
there?
A big, you know, it started as a bread ewe sale. Phil Seymour started it, and we had one barn up on this hill at that time. One barn. So now look at it. I mean.
So for everybody that is listening but not watching, how many barns do you think you have, maybe?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's barn 39 is up here, so there's probably, 40 barns.
40
and
barns.
And they've all expanded and contracted and different. And so, yeah, as one barn, and it was a bread ewe sale. That's all you could sell was bred ewes. Now we sell used, we have a huge used equipment auction, so you can buy spinning wheels and livestock feeders and looms and
sock
whatever you need.
And machine parts.
Yes, and as well as sheep. So.
Yes, and you have little, you have vendors that are selling silver, little ornaments, the kinds that you use for buttons and the kinds that you use for brooch.
Yes.
You have knitting needles. You have different kinds of wool. It's like the rainbow down there.
Exactly.
In terms of
if you can't find it here, you can't find it.
Yeah.
So
it's a beautiful thing. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next generation is going to come out there, and you'll have 22 volunteers instead of 17, right? Well, thank you, ladies, so much, because this is a lot of work, and I hope people understand that when they come in the door. If you all tell me why you're standing in a line together.
Shave them to save them.
Yeah. We're here to support the endangered breeds of sheep. And
okay, so
we're both fiber artists and we're shepherds.
Okay.
And we want the world to know that there's more than one kind of wool.
Yep.
And they all have their various purposes. But these breeds need love and attention.
Okay.
We want to keep the gene pool big.
Okay, so this is a livestock conservancy program, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Correct.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about that.
The Livestock Conservancy is an organization that is trying to save rare breeds for their genetic potentials and the traits that they each carry. And in order to do that, you have to give the animals a job. Farmers are not going to be able to raise them if they can't make some money on it.
Got to have purpose.
They need a purpose. It can't be just a hobby if you're going to get these animals in large enough numbers. And one of the things that many sheep are known for is having the dual purpose of both meat and wool. Unfortunately, for many of the breeds, the wool had not been recognized as having value. And this program, the idea behind it, is that the Livestock Conservancy can encourage fiber artists to use wools that are different from the average merino that most people are used to using, that have different qualities for different types of items, and encourage the shepherds to produce wool that fiber artists are going to want in a way that fiber artists are going to want it. So
is everybody wearing something from their Shave 'em to Save 'em?
Yes. Wool on my hat.
Okay. That does not look like a Jacob to me.
Then it's Jake.
It is.
Okay.
This is a felt made with Rommeldale CVM wool from my own flock.
You made that?
Yeah.
How do I buy that? That's beautiful.
Isn't it gorgeous?
Oh, my gosh.
And this is Tunis and Tunis.
American Tunis. And Tunis?
This is Rommeldale CVM. This, the two dyed are Clay Forest, and the gray in the back is Rommeldale CVM.
Okay, so that's all yours, or that's from other flocks too?
The Rommeldale is all mine. The Clun Forest I purchased from one of the other fiber providers.
Okay, beautiful.
And this is all CVM that I purchased from someone else and then I naturally dyed it.
Beautiful colors too. Love those colors.
And this has 7 different breeds represented.
You're just showing off now. So this program that you have, I mean, there's an incredible variety just standing here in front of me. And different breeds and different things that you can do and different things, that color patterns. All of those things are really a sort of a demonstration of the whole concept altogether, is it not?
Well, and one of my favorite parts about it as a shepherd but also as a knitter is getting to know each other,
right?
The shepherds and the fiber artists kind of getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping to get a better understanding of each other. Like, I know at one point when the program first started, there were people, artists, who were frustrated that various fibers were not available or yarns weren't available. Well, we hadn't sheared yet, you know? And so it was just kind of getting that understanding of the process of how wool is produced.
Right, that there's a timeline, and it's not 15 minutes.
No,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
No. And even once you send it to the mill, it can take a year to get back as yarn, you know. So so I've kind of enjoyed that part of it a lot, getting to know. And for me as a shepherd, learning what they want, you know, as far as how
it's understanding that there's different languages. There's the shepherd language, and there's the fiber artist language, and then there's normal everyday language.
Right.
The three are not the same.
No.
You commonly use the same word and it means totally different things. And not all of the shepherds especially understood the fiber artist language. And fiber artists, I think, can't figure out why or how you can raise animals that have wool and not understand what is staple length, what is micron count, what is handle, what is, you know, that. I mean, you're dealing with these every day. How can you not know what that means, you know? And yet, many of the shepherds have no clue what that means.
That's true.
And because a lot of them are dual-purpose breeds.
Right, and
so
they're raising them primarily
for
me.
For meat, or some people, like Jacobs, you know, some people, well, I'm Rommeldale's too, you know, some people will raise them for meat, and some people will raise them for wool.
Yep.
And, you know, and I think for me, it was so that people understood me charging $25 for a skein of yarn is still not paying for all my hay.
Yes. Right. Yes. I know. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. So yeah. It's hard when you're competing against
Walmart.
China, you know. Yeah.
And Walmart.
But you're not really, in a way, are you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, because people have this understanding of what yarn should cost.
Right. And, you know, and even at a festival like this, a lot of the independent dyers that are presenting stuff, it's basically made in China.
Yes.
And they're buying those yarns and then dyeing them. So they're doing a lot of added value. And it's a bit more expensive than you would buy at a normal, you know, yarn type thing. But not what we need to charge just to cover our costs. What they don't understand is what the cost of coverage is for making a skein of yarn. Don't count worrying about feeding or taking care of the animals or anything. But just what does it take to take a fleece that's laying here, send it to a mill, and come back with yarn? That cost, at least in my farm, has continually been at least $14 per 4-ounce skein.
So I think one of the benefits also of supporting us as small shepherds is that we are sending our wool to local small fiber mills. And so that's another value added, you know, part of it is it's not getting sent to a commercial, which wouldn't handle our fleeces, frankly.
So,
and so that's also another part of it is it's a slow, well, it's a slow fashion, right?
Slow fashion, right.
And that's kind of also an important thing that we do as a community is support other small.
So it's in my, at least the little that I know about it, is very much a reflection of the same concept that's happened in everything in agriculture. It used to be small farms, local processing, eat kind of locally, realize the cost locally. There was an attachment and a connection.
Yep.
And so now the fiber mills are going through the same concept, are they not? The wool is processed somewhere in Australia or wherever, goes to China for maybe car. I don't know what happens with wool. To be honest, it's still a little mystery to me. I'm going to go visit that site a little later. But, you know, it has to be processed and dyed, and then it comes back to the person that actually wants to use it. So it's dying in some ways in the same way that the small farmer has died and maybe getting a little resurgence now.
And I think it's programs like this that allow for the development of the relationships that people begin to understand what the value is. And unlike farm to table, where you can really know the person, you know, the farmer that's raising it or your customer, it's a little bit harder in the fiber community in that, you know, there's not that many people that live near me that want all my fleece. And so my community has to be much larger. And programs like this allow for that growth to happen. So.
And the life cycle is much, much longer.
Yeah.
But for wool than it is for vegetables, for instance. You know, the life cycle is one growing season, 3-4 months, between the time the seed's planted and somebody's eating in a restaurant. And with sheep,
we get one harvest a year,
and then it may take another year to get it processed.
I was thinking of my chickens and the egg, and the first time you get an egg or the first time you drop an egg, it's this horror in a completely different scale from the value of the actual egg because you knew what went into it.
So
it kills you because that egg was the sum of many different processes.
Yep.
And I'm assuming if you grow your own wool and you raise your own sheep, that bit of fiber is the representation of years of work, and that's before you ever get to the knitting part.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. And that's where it becomes critical to have skilled shearers.
Yes.
Because we get one shot at getting the fiber off of our sheep.
Yes.
And in some breeds, you're talking about a limited length of wool, and so you need a shearer who is good at handling your sheep kindly and can do their shearing with great skill to get as much as that wool, much of that wool off of that sheep as possible
in one piece
to keep it usable for those of us who are having product made or for us sending to hand spinners to use as well.
Tell me about your farm and your sheep.
Okay, so I'm Jerry Robinson Lawrence, and my farm is called Flying Fibers, and we live in York, Pennsylvania. I'm originally a city kid from Buffalo, New York, and always was the kid bringing home kittens and knew there was something in there. And I met my husband, who is English. First time I visited England, I saw these things from the airplane everywhere. And that was it. His parents took me to a South of England show. That's their agricultural fair. And I was hooked. That was it. That was the start.
So then you decide to say, I don't want a cat, I don't want a dog, I want a sheep that I'm going to bring home?
I always loved wool. And growing up in Buffalo, New York, you need it because the snowfall is tremendous. And I'm of Irish descent and English, I've just learned, Yorkshire, which is where they're from. And it was the warmest material there was. So we wore it all the time. It was completely natural. And I've always worked with my hands. I'm an artist by training. And the feel of the wool, it just worked. It was like magic for me.
So you and I have been joking about that, walking around like I'm wanting to touch everybody's sweater.
Yes, that's what we all do. And the other thing we do is go,
it smells so good.
It. Yes, now, especially right off the sheep.
It does. Now, that is that something that kind of sticks with it? Because I'm trying to figure out if some of the old sweaters that I have, if that's just my mind doing that.
I don't think it's your mind. When it's fresh, though, you can really smell them. Sometimes when it gets wet, you can still smell it. But when we get a fresh fleece, which is like... It's just heaven to us. It's a
now
perfect scent.
It feels, I have to just
yes,
ask because I think you'll be fine with
I
it.
I don't use any hand cream.
Okay, so the lanolin, I'm assuming, just really comes into your
yes.
hands and makes them soft as anything
yes.
if you knit constantly,
yes,
right?
If you knit with it. Some people strip the lanolin by overwashing it. Some people actually add lanolin back in. You can buy lanolin and use it on your wool. People will also soak their sweaters in lanolin if they work outside because the lanolin is what will repel the water even more so. So stripping all the oils out of it is not a good thing. You want to keep them in there.
So I think that's great. Now tell me about that and why that unique characteristic of
the
wool.
Lanolin. Oil and water don't mix.
Yes.
So it's like an oil. So the water just rolls right off it.
But it also seems to somehow be a moisturizer in a way, or is that just the fact that it retains
water?
Well,
our skin receives the oils, but the sweater itself, if it's raining, will repel it. So, yeah, it's kind of the magic product, isn't it?
It is
sheep
the magic.
Are amazing.
It is the magic. You might have some big, hefty sheep shearing, and he's got soft, soft, soft
yes.
hands.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Okay, so tell me about some of the other characteristics of wool.
So it's a fire retardant. It's biodegradable. They're a sustainable component of our ecosystem. So if you have sheep, you have fertilizer, and you have meat. I raise mine for wool primarily. I have to say I haven't eaten mine. People do, and it's perfectly fine. So they're the entire system. They're the cycle of life. They give us, and if we give them love, it's just perfect harmony.
Now, in many ways, these are used as pasture restoration animals,
yes.
correct? So they
yes.
do quite a bit to distribute. Obviously, they're going to eat. They're browsers, correct?
Yes.
They're grazers.
Well, but some of mine will browse. It depends on how tasty it is and if it's like berry bushes and some berry leaves. And you do have to be careful because some things are toxic, but they love willow. Willow is a great, if coppiced, willow will keep growing and provide fodder. That's one of the things they love most. And I hadn't told you this, but I'm actually on the board for the Horn Farm Center in York, Pennsylvania. In Hellam, actually, and it is a center for regenerative farming practices, and primarily the goal is to educate the public. So one of the things they're very interested in with this entire cycle is that you can use a silvopasture method where you have trees that can provide nuts for you, that can provide your posts for your fencing if you have locusts. The sheep fertilize the trees, so it's just this perfect harmony. And you would rotationally graze, so you could bring cows through first, then sheep, then chickens. Ducks are a little lighter, they don't scratch the earth up as much. And so you rotate, and then the soil composition, everything just works in harmony. So that's really exciting too.
So now this is also, this can be a regional thing, correct? Because there's a lot that we talk about with carbon sequestration.
Yes.
And the ability, yes, of the ground to regenerate.
Yes.
But somebody in Nevada is not necessarily going to have the same kind of regeneration characteristics as somebody in Connecticut.
Right. So and in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
So we have a lot of rock in Pennsylvania. So they actually help get our seed into the ground and get everything in with their little delicate feet. Even though they're massive, they work nicely for that. And I don't know what someone in Nevada would do.
They have Navajo churros and they live in 120 degree weather, and they are fairly drought tolerant animals, very low, at least that's my understanding anyway,
yeah,
very low resource dependent, and they give wool. But it's a different kind of wool than,
right,
the sheep. So,
right,
sheep have been regionally adapted,
yes,
to accomplish different purposes, correct?
Yes,
and that's one,
correct,
of the nice things about them is it's a smaller animal that you can kind of take here and there, and they've been,
yes,
a part of our history, have they not?
Part of history for us. Well, yes, they're in the Bible, if you think of the Jacob's sheep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
the spotted sheep of Jacob, and yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the sheep I raise are primarily English breeds because of my lineage and my husband's lineage coming from Yorkshire. So these are, the Wensleydale is one of the largest breeds in England. And so it's been used, it's dual purpose. So it can be used for meat or wool. And it has been used to improve the carcass size of the hill breeds in England, their meat breeds.
Like what would be a hill breed?
A Swaledale would be one of the most popular. And but they've used it on a lot of different breeds. But the Swaledale is the one that's used on most frequently. And so they improve the carcass size. You get more meat. They're hardier. They can grow 12 to 14 inches in a year.
Wow.
So not only can they improve the carcass size and bulk up other sheep, but they have magnificent wool properties. So.
Okay, so now this is one of the components that we think is really interesting, is the ability to take the ingredients and mix them to make a different cake.
Right.
So if you do have one characteristics and you mix it into another sheep, the common question is, well, why don't you just keep that sheep and then you never need this one again?
So for me, it's the genetics are significant to our cultural history and also to learning. So these breeds, the heritage breeds, when the scrapie epidemic hit England and the British Isles in around 2000, wiped out flocks everywhere of the new sheep, the ones that we've modified and essentially created over time. The heritage breeds did not get scrapie. So they could be directly adjacent to a flock that had scrapie and had to be killed. They did not have it. So the heritage breeds have something in their genetic background that makes them resistant to these diseases that are wiping out other breeds today. So we have a lot that we can learn from them genetically, and maybe what we've made isn't so good after all. Why didn't they die?
And we don't always know what it is.
We don't know what it is yet.
That might be that one characteristic.
Yes.
Of that. Yeah. We got,
yes,
to talk to Temple Grandin, and she mentioned hawk disease in pigs and how they're 5 years into breeding for more production or a bigger,
yep,
weight. And five,
yes,
years in, they found out that this thing that they thought they were getting was causing another thing to trigger genetically.
Right.
And then they have to go back and try and get it out.
Yes.
But how do you get it out? You bring,
how do you get it out?
Something else back in.
Yes.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm a firm believer in keeping them alive and around and unique. So no other animal is exactly like this. And if you eat different lambs, different sheep breeds, or mutton, they all taste different. So,
yes,
wider,
yes,
variety. It's not homogenized. And I also don't know details on this, but I know that our food has far less nutritional value now than it did in the 1950s.
And it's,
what have we done?
What have we done? And some of the older breeds are not necessarily made to put on weight at a really fast,
correct,
rate. And so,
correct,
you want a sheep that's been around 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
Uji raises black Welsh Mountain Sheep, and she said to us that there's a difference in terms of the amount of minerals that a sheep will intake and implant into their body. When you think about it, maybe it might take 4, 5, 6 years to get that same number of minerals. So you need a sheep that has a little age on it.
Yes.
You eat it at 1 or 2, it's not going to do that same process, and it will taste different.
And my husband, coming from England, he only ever ate mutton. He never ate lamb. So they must have been somewhere in history knew that they take that long to grow. And yeah, we've, as Americans, have supersized everything.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please tell your friends to join us. Please feel free to post any questions or comments that you might have to our social media sites. Our Twitter feed is at Backyard Green Films, spelled BKYRDGREENFILMS. Our Instagram is at Backyard Green Films, BACKYARDGREENFILMS. Our Facebook is Backyard Green Films. Our YouTube URL is youtube.com/backyardgreenfilms.
We want to thank all the gracious people who helped us at the New York State Sheep and Wool Festival this year. We want to especially thank Jerry from Flying Fibers Farm and Nina, who is head of the volunteers at this great event. If you'd like more information, please visit sheepandwool.com. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes from our travels. We'd also like to thank our producer, Michelle Council. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2019.